March 2020 was a pivotal month in New York as COVID-19 escalated rapidly. People were talking about the virus for months before it began to make a sobering impact in New York. Within days and then weeks, the situation was becoming more dire. Public institutions were making decisions to shut down. Those who could work from home got to work from home in whatever circumstances they found themselves. Universities were the first to begin migrating courses online. Schools were next. Things took on new meanings. Home, classrooms, self-preservation, exposure, risk. The pandemic reverberated through every sector of society. Our social systems were coming to a clumsy halt, or at least an uncertain pause. We became an epicenter of the pandemic, our numbers spreading the virus like wildfire as the healthcare system scrambled to support greater numbers of those infected. The pandemic is bringing to fruition the inequalities in our society, the shortcomings of our systems, the nature of reliance and interdependence, and our violences and vulnerabilities. Daily broadcasts of the death toll have become a new normal, and yet still surreal. Teaching during these times is characterized by instability, trepidation, confusion, and much more. By late March, CUNY had undergone a massive migration to the digital sphere. 90% of courses were transitioned online. Faculty, educators, students, and administrators were directed to work remotely. But in the midst of panic, uncertainty, and fear, there is an opportunity for radical pedagogical intervention. My name is Sakina Lexi-Mimaro, and I am a fellow at the Teaching and Learning Center in the GC. In this conversation, I talk with Michelle Fine, Distinguished Professor of Psychology and Urban Education at the Graduate Center.
My immediate little crowd is fine. We'll talk more about it, but students are really suffering. And, you know, my little son teaches sixth graders in a very low income, beautiful school in Maryland. And so they're, you know, they're just having a hard time. And
yeah,
everybody's waiting to hear what the Supreme Court's going to say about DACA, and
right,
imagining the future feels hard. So privileged, sad, enraged. Yeah. Confused, waiting for a vice presidential candidate, all that.
Yeah, I that difficulty of imagining the future is very real right now, even on a personal level, like trying to think about finishing this dissertation and then and then go into what. So yeah.
No, exactly. You know, David, my partner, teaches at St. Peter's, and they're furloughing a bunch of faculty. My son, Sam, he's an adjunct at Gutman, but, you know, he had an interview with Kingsborough. They all got canceled. I don't know what's waiting for us all.
So do you mind if I ask you some of these questions that I'd prepared?
Fine.
So the first question was, how has it been for you teaching through the crisis?
All right, if you promise not to tell anybody, there's been something about meeting with our doctoral students on Zoom during the crisis that's been very intimate and beautiful.
Mm. Wow.
You know, we need hugs and touch and to be present in the same room, but I think when you already have a community of yearning and trust and pain and desire and connection, when the world feels very cold, there's been something. Desiree Bird and I are co-teaching a course on, it's called Dis-Ease in Contentious Times.
Ooh, so it's
around anxiety and mental illness. And white supremacy and capitalism and COVID now. And And every week, it's Wednesday mornings. It's just a beautiful gathering of desire. That's not the case for my partner or sons who are teaching sixth graders or community college students or working class kids who are sick themselves and have family members who are dying and lost jobs. They are, I think, it's been amazing to connect, but just so drenched, saturated in pain. Our doctoral students, many of them are affected, particularly students of color, like close in affected family. But there's been something quite beautiful about seeing people. And I think it's changed a little how I teach in ways that I think your questions will get to. But it does feel more intimate. Like yeah. If it were mandated, if it were corporate, if it were always like this, or in the fall, I don't know what it's going to feel like with strangers, you know?
Probably really go off with how it feels like right now. Yeah, I found that too. I found that I'm collaborating with my workmates in a different way. Like it's more intentional.
Yeah.
And the time is spent a little bit more intentional. And it's been nice to kind of see people in their space as well.
Totally. To hear grandmothers and babies and cats and.
Yeah, it's definitely.
See that I have naked women all over my walls. And they're all sketches by friends. But yeah, no, it's a different kind of comfort. I also, I'm more likely, and I don't think I do this live, to say to a student, so what do you think? I think in a classroom that feels aggressive,
right.
But online I'll call on someone and say, I know you've been thinking about this, and it doesn't feel aggressive to me or I think to them.
That's interesting.
We did it with some eighth graders, and a lot of them didn't want their pictures, and they were chatting. But even there, the chat gave, I don't know, different voices. It's a little polyphonic, you know, like different selves can emerge.
That's beautiful.
Yeah.
So, what have you learned about yourself as an educator?
How much I like touching, how much I need relationship, I worry in my own head about the balance between, particularly at the doctoral level, like very participatory courses where the students are doing a lot of the work, and the fact that I'm getting paid for it and they're paying kind of for it. So, you know, the classes feel very full and participatory, and I think we're all learning a ton, but I'm not sure we're all reading as much as we were, and so I feel responsible to hold the space and attend to both the pain and the wisdom that each person and then collectively we're bringing to the discussion. Like 2 weeks ago, we had a panel of formerly incarcerated people talking about how mental illness is treated in prison. And, you know, you can't talk about that at this moment without addressing COVID and folks who are still locked up. And so I'm never a very linear teacher, as you might know, but holding the space feels even more precious, and it's like a sacred space. And I made a mistake. We had that week of visitors, I invited somebody to join us, and I think the students minded that. You know, the next week they said, oh, somebody joined us without even being introduced.
Oh.
And I've realized something about the sacredness of the space. And I hope I can bring that into the room when we're all together, because I think that even happened in the class that you and I were in. Like, I invite a lot of people, but not everybody's comfortable with open borders. And you finally get comfort. And then I offered a writing session just for anybody who wanted a creative nonfiction writing. And that was really gorgeous. But again, just very, it feels very sacred and tentative and loving and deep. And like usually tentative is superficial, but right. This, you know, feels like any of us could die at any minute. And so our time together is very precious.
That's nice. I'm wondering, because you said the space was very intimate and you used the word border, but I also wonder how this is also about boundaries. Those differences between borders and boundaries.
Yeah.
So I'll just ask the question about how has it been working from home while sheltering in place and navigating these new boundaries between, you know, work, life, relationships, different kinds of relationships happening in space, digitally and otherwise.
So again, I'm pretty lucky. I live in a big house. I have my own space to work. We have 7 people living here now. And my 2 sons, David and myself, my son's partner and their little girl, this 6-month-old Rosie, and we have one of David's students who's living with us. So it's been kind of beautiful, like learning, I wouldn't use borders or boundaries here because we're all like working the space and the labor. And like the first week we alternated who cooked, and then it was clear some of us were really lousy at it. And so then we specialize, and other people, I'm not a great cook. And so other people cook and some of us clean up. And then Anna, who's living with us, decided to convert the garage into a gym. So she and I work out there. And before dinner, we all go around and have to say one good thing, which is getting hard.
6 weeks in,
but we do. And so in the first week, I did a lot of checking in on all my students. As you know, I have a lot. And
how many students?
You know, I'm probably the chair for like 25 or so, or second, or right. The auntie, or I'm an auntie to a lot. And you know, and people's needs change.
Right.
You know, like the first week people were very autonomous, and then we have first exams in our program, and I was checking in like, do you want us to, you know, cancel that and move it to September? Or and people were a mix of, no, I could do this, I love it, and ashamed to ask for more time. Then somebody's dad died and somebody lost others. So it's gotten very, we've tried to keep it very collaborative and student-centered. But every day changes on what people need and want to admit they need. And they're scared it'll, there was some rumor that if you don't take the exam, you'll, I don't know, you won't get credit for the something. And it was, and we only know the rumors when we hear it secretly from somebody.
Right.
So, you know, trying to honor everybody's privacy and assume that if somebody has a need, maybe more than that one person has that need, in an institution that's absolutely resource dry, but commitment rich. You know, at any time of the day, I can write to Nicole Elton in the Wellness Center, or Luke, or Matt Schoengood, or Ann Ellis, and I do. I write to them all the time. And they respond, because there are some anchors in the building of people who've been around a long time or just are very, very generous. And so even though it feels catastrophic, it feels like a boat that's trembling, but there are a couple of people who are anchors and are worrying about the, and I don't know that that's true everywhere.
Yeah. Well, thank you. I was wondering if you're able to share some strategies that you've had for self-care or family care that you've developed during these times. I know you've touched a little bit on that by, you know, doing the evening ritual and things like that.
So I have really slowed down in a way that's kind of beautiful and zen. Like usually I'm traveling, you know, I'm
on the go.
I am on the go. And, you know, it's probably related to home being the place you leave. That was the model for me. My dad was that, and my mother was home, but depressed. So home was sad, depressed, and having a full life was out in the world. And so I travel. And I mean, you know, this semester I was supposed to be in Costa Rica, Santa Cruz, Australia, I think the end of this, you know, and here I am on Zoom. But I kind of like it. I like the slowness of it. I like the intentionality, to use your word. It feels like taking enough time matters. Mm. And that if you let the air breathe a little, everyone wants to breathe together. So my mornings now are taking care of this grandbaby, which is hilarious. And we read the same books every day, and we sing, and we, although she's growing. And that's really fun. Again, in the past, I think I'd be checking my phone while I'm with her and on the phone and holding her, and it's really dedicated time. And then I work, and then Anna and I go to the gym, which is a garage that smells like dog piss. So I think a lot about like dog piss and dirt and, ew, how do I live like this? And we all do dinner together. I have never done that. When I'm at CUNY, I'm there till 7-8. I grab crappy food in those like markets where it's been sitting greased for all day. I actually really like the grease, I'm embarrassed to tell you. But I just have my glass of wine, and then we all watch crappy TV or wonderful TV. We're watching the show Insecure with Issa Rae. Oh my God.
Yes, I've seen it. I love it, yeah.
Oh my God. And then my sons are like, Ma, I can't believe we're watching this with you. It's totally fun.
She has a little memoir that's really lovely.
Outside that or in that?
No, outside that, and where she talks about making the show and getting to that position.
Oh, is that right? Oh, I love her. Oh my God, I love her.
She has a great voice, also written like in text, yeah.
Is that right? Oh, I'll find it. Anyway, so that's really fun. And then we binge a little on those, and we all say, can we do one more? And if we're not too, it's a very emotional show. It makes you sad or enraged or embarrassed or sexy or something. Then we do another one, and then I watch the news and hear how many people died and the fact that we're never getting out of here, and then I go to sleep.
Right after the news, too.
Oh, yeah. No, absolutely.
Yeah.
And I check in with friends a lot. I check in with students a lot. I don't want to push, but I want people to know I'm available and not feel like they can't. So it's been, you know, now I've noticed that we don't let us all go down the same night. Like it's like synchronized swimming of emotions. Like only one of us or two of us can go down, and somebody has to be up. And usually that's my job. So when I go down, everybody's really worried.
Everybody's gotta step in.
Exactly. Like, Mom, let's watch Insecure. Right.
It's interesting that, like, in the midst of these crises and devastation, like, personally and worldwide, and I think we're a little bit sheltered from it as people that are not, like, emergency workers that have to go out and do these things. But I feel like even among this catastrophe, there are some really wonderful things that are coming out of it.
Totally.
People connecting in new ways, people forced to teach in new ways, and as well as, like, kind of, like, re-know their space and repurpose their space and
totally
develop some form of self-sufficiency in this very consumerist society. So, like, thinking about how we consume and all these things. So I'm also wondering, as a final question, what do you imagine can come out of the pandemic for the future of the university? Do you think that we can kind of go in a different direction than we've been heading in the aftermath of something so destabilizing?
Yeah. So have you seen the Arundhati Roy piece on the pandemic as a portal?
No.
Oh, look it up. It's beautiful. You know, that this isn't a rupture. The ruptures were always there. This is an opportunity for us to reimagine and see through it. And we have a responsibility to think about what comes out the other end. So I guess I have a range of thoughts. One is I feel like not all faculty, but a lot of faculty have come to appreciate, and I know students have, the full lives of everyone, that we're not just teachers or students, or and boundaries and borders are porous. We're all vulnerable. Any of us could have died. Some of us lost people. That we're profoundly interdependent, and that's a gift, or it will kill us. Like, if we ignore it, or if we allow those with pre-existing conditions of poverty and racism to fall, we're all going to fall. So that's not selfish, unselfish. It's just that we're profoundly linked.
It seems that people are working more now.
It feels like I am. I'm working a lot. I mean, I always work all the time, so I don't know that I would say more.
Yeah.
But it's a full day.
Yeah, it is.
It's a full day, and the question of meaning is heavier. Mm. You know, like, for what? Who's going to read this? Huh? You know, like, really? Like, Marie and I just finished a book on critical PAR, and the ending, we said, you know, it's a sweet and sour pleasure that so many people during the quarantine are saying, can you help me? We're working with prisoners in Scotland, and we're working with battered women who are quarantined in homes. We're working with children at the border, and we want to root. And so people are seeing our solidarities, but thinking through what's tomorrow feels tricky.
Yeah,
it does. Especially at a place like the Graduate Center, which is it's a mirage and a desire and a WeWork building. And, you know, it's both like what should be and what is. And it's a fun house. It's never quite what it should be. There's nowhere I'd rather be. But
it's our other home, I guess.
It is our other home. It must be dusty.
Yeah. Well, thank you. I really appreciate your time.
Yeah, take care, sweetie. I'll see you soon. I'll send you something.
Yeah, I would love that. I'd love to read it.
Good. Thanks. Bye. See you. Bye.
This is a love letter by Michelle Fine. In the morning after, educators realize we cannot go back to normality, as Arundhati Roy has warned us. Through the portal of massive death and illness, racialized and classed a grotesque widening of educational gaps and inequalities, economic despair on the rise in ways starkly stratified, we confront enduring inequalities that pave our nation, make it easy for some of us and impossible for others. So now we know and can't deny that some schools have pre-existing conditions and are thereby more vulnerable to the virus. Racial injustice, privatization, testing, over-policing, deportation raids, and trauma. We can never say we didn't know. Schools with pre-existing conditions, hollowed and threatened by the corporate and carceral logics, succumb first. These are schools with too many police, too much testing, high teacher turnover, heightened and racially disparate suspension and expulsion rates. Too many long-term subs, and aggressive threats of closure if scores don't rise. These are the pre-existing conditions that create a host environment for the virus, COVID or privatization. These pre-existing vulnerabilities are held in the bodies of the children and in the precarious structures of their schools. We'll be right back.